Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the War Report. I think you all know that I'm in Buffalo, and yes, it's cold. I have been cold almost ever since I left Los Angeles, and this is no exception. We have a really jam-packed show today in that we got two guests here who are teachers, and one no longer teaching right now, but she's in graduate school getting a doctorate, who have very long histories here. One has gone to, I think, public school here and then graduated and went on to college, came back as a teacher. Kids gone to school here. Buffalo is what I think, and I think most people here agree with me, is ground zero for Governor Cuomo's out-and-out war to destroy public education and to replace it with a privatized statewide system. I learned once I got here that not only is Buffalo ground zero, but there are four other cities that are also similarly being warred upon, but not to the extent that it's taking place here in Buffalo. I don't want to go too far in this because I want them to tell you all about it. I didn't know about what was happening in the other cities. They'll identify for them. I knew about New York. We all know about New York, but that's what's reported on all the time. And the original plan was to come to Buffalo, then to New York, or to New York, then come up to Buffalo. I got here Monday night. Long 12-hour train ride, bus-train combination. And within 20 minutes, just like my experience in Maine, I knew that Buffalo, not New York City, was the place to be and that this was where the story is. I'm going to have our guests on in a minute, but let me also tell you, I'm going to stay in Buffalo almost another week, folks. That's how important Buffalo is to the war on public education. With that, let me introduce Eve Shippens. She'll tell you about herself. And Kate Hawk. And she'll tell me if I pronounce her name correctly. Welcome, both Eve and Kate. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having us.
I'm fine, okay. And you did a great job on my name, Dr. Miller. Thank you.
Okay, so I won't be slapped. Okay, that's so good. Because everybody knows that I am bad on names. Other than Smith, Jones, and Miller, I screw it up frequently. Let me start with saying, Eve, why don't you introduce yourself, and then Kate, and then we'll get into what's happening here in Buffalo.
Hi, I'm Eve, and I am a 30-plus-year resident of the city of Buffalo. My family moved here when I was 5. I attended the Buffalo Public Schools as a child during the height of our school's success. It was the magnet program due to desegregation, and I went to some very high-quality Buffalo public schools. I have raised my family in Buffalo, and all three of my kids have attended the Buffalo Public Schools, and I'm also a teacher in Martin Luther King, which is one of the Buffalo Public Schools that is being phased out and shut down.
Okay. Kate?
Hi, I'm Kate, and I am a little bit older than Eve. I moved to Buffalo in 1979 to go to college, and I never left. And my husband and I decided to stay and bring up our family here in the city. We did that purposefully because my husband is originally from Pakistan, and being in a diverse community was very important to us. So I became a teacher at Buffalo State College. I got my undergraduate degree, and I got a job in a rural suburb in 1987. At that point, it was real farm community, but now it's much more of a bedroom community for Buffalo. It's about 40 minutes outside the city, and I taught there for many years. And just in 2014, because of a lot of the changes that I know we're going to talk about on this program, I decided that I could no longer stay. I had a moral problem with what was going on in education in terms of the developmentally inappropriate curriculum and the testing schedule. So I made a decision to leave. I wasn't old enough to retire, and so I resigned. Now, in the meantime, my family lives here in the city, and I have three children who have gone to Buffalo Public Schools, two of whom have graduated, and they actually were not affected by the neoliberal agenda that has come in. They sort of skated out. My oldest graduated in 2008, and my second son graduated in 2011. But my youngest is caught right in the thick of things. He's a 10th grader at a Buffalo City school. And I'm presently a parent advocate and a graduate student at the University of Buffalo.
Okay. The war on public education is now here in Buffalo. When did it start here? Well, let me go back. I know from my own research and talking to the, I don't know how many people we've interviewed since I've been here, that Buffalo, one, was a rather racially diverse community back in the 50s, 60s, and et cetera, was also one of the most segregated communities in the country.
It actually still is. It's one of the most segregated cities in the country currently.
Okay. And that when they were forced more or less to integrate the schools like the rest of the country, that was a huge problem here. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But there were attempts to start the privatization of public education. Am I right? Before 2002, with the signing into law of No Child Left Behind. Am I right on that?
That was signed, in 2001 or two, the No Child Left Behind. But I'm not sure how long we've had charter schools in the city. I'm trying to think back, and Eve, maybe you can help me, whether they were here prior to that. I'm not certain of that.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have mentioned it, but yeah, I've been told that before 2002, there was move for charter schools here. And of course, since 2002, that's been ramped up at all.
Right.
Both of you
we
were
do
teaching.
Have quite a few charter schools.
Okay. Both of you were teaching in 2002?
I started teaching in March of 2001. So, yeah, I had just become a teacher.
Okay. Eve, you.
Yes.
Your experience, since you were both a student here, now parent, and now a teacher, now an activist, your years as a student, and be able to compare that to your years when you started teaching, and then how has it evolved now?
Well, when I was a student, I started off in a neighborhood school in Buffalo. We had over 100 school buildings spread across the city. So at that time, there were still a lot of neighborhood schools, and people would walk to them for the most part. But somewhere when I was like maybe third or fourth grade, they started opening up more and more magnet program schools where there would be certain criteria for entrance and there would be special programs that would attract kids. The whole idea was to attract you to a school that was more diverse racially than forced busing. So that was Buffalo's solution to desegregation. And I, in fifth grade, ended up at Olmsted, which was a school for gifted and talented students, supposedly. You know, so I got into that program, and I had a great experience. Again, the diverse as far as both economic and race.
Now, wasn't that one of the claims of fame for Buffalo, that you had the, perhaps the best magnet school program in the country?
Actually, we did. I mean, people came from, educators came from all over the country to investigate our program because the way that it was set up worked so well. It was a choice school district, and it was working. But the problem, my understanding of it is, the problem that occurred was because desegregation was put into place through the courts, once the court decided that, in fact, Buffalo had been desegregated, the city had been contributing a large amount of money towards our school district. And once the court said, okay, you are fully integrated, and that legal ramification was removed, then the city removed funding. And, of course, eventually the state removed a lot of funding as well. And so, bit by bit, the magnet school model was sort of disintegrated. And
yeah,
now we're left with
left,
just a few criterion schools.
And, yeah, what was left was the federal government money, the grant money for desegregation was, of course, that disappeared as well. Currently, our city contributes less than 8% towards the school budget. And this, of course, has been a big issue. It's the least amount that any of the big five cities in New York State contribute to their actual school systems. So the lack of funding is a big deal. In 2001, when 9/11 happened and that pulled state money from the Buffalo Public Schools, that was a crisis that then the state, right there in the middle, actually the beginning of the year, said we can't give the Buffalo Public Schools the money that we budgeted because we need to clean up New York City. And it was one of those emergency situations like Katrina that you couldn't argue with. How could you argue with it? There were people who had died and there were people who were sick because of what had happened on 9/11. So by January of 2002, they had laid off more than 433 Buffalo teachers. And this is where, on top of losing money over time, because we're now supposedly segregated schools and we didn't have to be monitored, and that money didn't have to go into our schools, in 2001 with 9/11, this investment by the state in our schools was suddenly pulled out, and we lost all these teaching positions, and we lost, with teaching positions, we lose electives. We lose individualized instruction. We have larger class sizes. And it was a real devastation to our district. That was just another step where we went bare bones. You know, if it wasn't a mandate, we didn't have that program.
And so, for instance, the Olmsted school that Eve mentioned earlier, which is a gifted and talented school, then lost its gifted and talented programming for a while, as well as its specifically trained gifted and talented teachers. So then you had a magnet school without the actual programming in it. And that some of that has since been restored, but so you can see it was a very... it was a process that happened over a period of years, and I feel badly that it happened sort of right before our eyes. And this is one of the things that has really got me, my critical conscience, really running hard about how it happened under while we were here, but now we're in a panic because we see that our public schools, as we know them, could be, you know, also bit by bit eroded again before our eyes.
It's been 15 years of complete devastation to our district, stripping away of everything good, underfunding, cutting programs, cutting staffing, on top of a real attack on teachers as professionals. And it's been going on. And, yeah, I was a teacher during this whole time. And for some reason, you know, it with the start of it being, oh, 9/11 happened. You can't argue with these things. You have an emotional reaction to a tragedy that then when we should have stood up right away and said, you can't cut our money. You can't. These are our children. We didn't step up because how could we compete with a real tragedy of people dying? But there's been a whole generation. 15 years is a child's whole educational career. And so we've had a whole generation that has lost what I had when I went to the Buffalo Public Schools. My children have lost what I had when I was going through the Buffalo Public Schools, and my students are losing. And it really puts them in a position where they're not getting a love for learning because it's so stripped down. There's nothing to enjoy.
Add to that, the No Child Left Behind, because I have said on the show for almost 20 months now, in my view, it was the signing of No Child Left Behind that ushered in a formal declaration of war on public education. Before that, before the actual signing of it, yes, across the country, there were states, school districts who were trying to do their bit to undo the court order to integrate, to provide a quality education, et cetera. But it was, I won't say random, but it wasn't connected. It was what was happening in a given state, and particularly in the southern states. With No Child Left Behind, that gave it a national face. That gave it the way to not only try to deal with desegregating the schools or resegregating the schools, it gave schools a way to become privatized. Now, that's my argument. So, here in Buffalo, with all the things that have been happening that you ladies have both mentioned, throw on top of that No Child Left Behind and the formal declaration of war as it was played out here or has been playing out here.
So I could speak to that, Dr. Miller. Because we had so many financial losses to our district, and of course now the teaching staff after 9/11 was also curtailed, we started using things like scripted curriculum. And of course the yearly testing in grades 3 through 8 that came with No Child Left Behind focused our attention and our curriculum towards this end-of-the-year test. So the curriculum itself not only became scripted as the district bought scripted programming that all teachers had to employ, and from the district perspective, if they have, you know, untried or untested teachers or fewer teachers and more students in a classroom, they wanted everybody to be on the same page, so they bought into these. And, of course, there's a monetary push behind that. There's a corporate push behind that. But so the curriculum became narrowed, which now No Child Left Behind said some of the reasons that they were testing kids every year was to make sure that underrepresented kids would be counted. But what's really happened is, according to the research that I've done, it has actually increased racial gaps for students, economic gaps, and access to the arts. So all of these things came in that gaping hole that we had after 9/11, and it's really produced an even an even deeper sort of dual education system where now, of course, we're all resegregated again. And we recently had the Office of Civil Rights come and investigate the way that our Criterion schools are accepting students, because in some of the Criterion schools, the demographics are way skewed. They don't reflect the demographics of our city. And to make it short and sweet, the better, more academically programmed schools in general have more white students in them than the less intense academic schools. Would you agree with that, Eve?
I definitely would agree with that. And it's been shown through the OCR report. But also where this has played out is our persistently struggling schools in a district that's only 51% African American. Most of our persistently struggling schools are over 90% African American. So you see this completely segregated schools. If you walk through the buildings, you see a difference in the resources between these schools and the criteria-based schools. And you're definitely seeing the outcomes very different.
So we get, again, we're piling on now with No Child Left Behind. And then, of course, later on, Race to the Top. But in between, from 2002 to Race to the Top, there's some other things that were happening here that had a major impact, that were war-related impact. And I think some of what I've learned from both of you and others is the almost the gentrification of the schools in a sense, of neighborhoods, in the sense that privatizers, maybe particularly one individual, start buying up dilapidated property, buying up schools that were considered no longer useful. Tell me about that, because that's a direct impact.
Well, one of our school board members is a real estate developer, and he owns a lot of the business property in the city. So he does business with government, he does business with politicians, and he does business with other successful business people. He has been quoted in saying that his job on the school board is to dismantle the Buffalo Public Schools. And he's definitely come on board. He's been very divisive. He has been sexist. He has been racist. He has been insulting to parents. He has been insulting to students who come and speak at the board. He tells them that their stories don't matter. And it's mind-boggling to think that this man has bought himself a seat on the Board of Education and that people think that this is okay when he is not a stakeholder in the children of the city. He has no real interest except them as commodities. And he's made that very clear. And it's a shame that he has any power at all, because he's definitely part of this agenda that is turning our schools into places where we develop human beings into something that is just bottom-line driven. We only care about them based on the money that could be made off of them, based on the money that we could squeeze out of the system, and based on who we can replace them with. Like if we have selective charter schools that are primed and ready to take in an expanding gentrified population. So it's a very scary time in Buffalo.
Okay.
And we know
Let me remind people that they can call in. We have several lines that are open for those of you who want to call in, especially those of you who live here in Buffalo or the surrounding areas. Okay, go ahead, Kate.
I was going to say that we know that some of the schools that have been that are designated as receivership schools now actually last year we had to get real active real quick because some of the schools we understood were being toured by charter school representatives as they were allowed to come in and sort of check out the school itself in preparation for a possible move-in or a purchase agreement with the school board. So we all really worked hard at going to board meetings and speaking out against this idea that charter schools had the right, first of all, and I'm sure that your listeners are aware that in New York City there are some charter schools that have actually moved into public schools and shared space with them. So we were
co-location.
We were concerned that that was going to be an issue too. So so we pushed back and pushed it off for a while, but we still don't know, you know, how that's going to work. And of course, having that developer on the board keeps us all on edge because he does have a vested interest in charter schools because he leases the school buildings to the charters.
Eve?
And part of this is that the federal government has given Buffalo some grant money and low-interest loans to rehab our school system. Our school buildings were mostly built pre-1940, so it's old building stock. And we've been in over a decade of rebuilding our schools. Last year, the state ed department declared four of our 57 Buffalo public schools out of time, that they had gone through the SIG grant, the transformation process, and they didn't make adequate yearly progress, so that these four schools were going to be phased out. All four of these schools are in renovated buildings. One of them, East High School in Buffalo, has the best science labs in the city. So all these buildings are prime, renovated buildings that you could go in, and if you're a charter school, of course you'd want them. They're to be able to have these turned back to the city and then to lease them out for pennies on the dollar, a completely renovated building, while the district, the Buffalo Public School District, will still be paying back the loan to the federal government and the interest. And the charter school will already have a renovated building that they never have to pay for the renovations for. How could you turn our public resources into non-public entities? It's just not right.
We have a caller, so let's bring our caller in. Hi, caller.
Hello. Hello, Dr.
Who are you?
This is Dr. Neville Gold.
Oh,
I'm fine. I was listening to the program. And I just wanted to thank you for highlighting Buffalo. The two ladies that you have on are very well informed. They've been providing some excellent information. I did want to add something, and I came into
the
program a little
late. Let me just stop you 1 second, Dr.
Evergo.
Let me say, she is a board member, folks, and she is one of our staunchest supporters and protectors of public schools here, and I say an hour because I'll tell you about that later, that we have. So it is such a pleasure that she is listening in and she's calling in. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. As I said, I came into the program a little late, about a quarter after five, I think. And while you were discussing some of the problems that historically that have led to what we're experiencing now in Buffalo, I wanted to add, if it wasn't discussed, the whole destabilization of our administrative leadership since 2011, I think, you know, and that we're only talking about 4 years. We've now on our seventh superintendent. And so that, I think, has played a major part in helping to destabilize the system and to undermine us such that it makes us vulnerable for state takeover. And then certainly the district itself, I believe, has been targeted by the state education department and the commissioners there. Therefore, in terms of the mandates, I know that had some discussion about the out-of-time schools and what all of that has meant in the context of now getting to these persistently struggling and struggling schools and receivership. But this has been a systematic, I believe, undermining and targeting of the Buffalo Public Schools to make us an example or a poster child that could be used as a model for how one takes over public schools in the state of New York.
I have said this both in Maine, and I said it once I got here. I use the analogy that this is like the canary in the mine shaft. I mentioned this last week, so let me just clarify what I mean. You know that the miners who work deep down underground, and that there's always a possibility of gas, poisonous gas, circulating and then filling up the mine shaft. It was sometime, I don't know when, it was discovered that if you took a canary and put it in a cage and put it in the mine, that the canary would be the first one to die, and thus you get an early warning that the mine shaft is filling up with poisonous gas, you better get out. I see what's happening at Buffalo. Buffalo is that canary in the mine shaft, especially when we talk about there are five school districts in the state that are being warred upon by the governor and all of the privatization forces. But Buffalo is the prime target, and I think you ladies will agree with me, Buffalo is the prime target of the five. If you can take Buffalo down, then the model can be replicated across the state.
Well, I can believe you're absolutely right. You know, the governor put out a report, I believe it was earlier this year, perhaps in January, in which he, you know, had all of these schools that were failures, all of these, and at that time they weren't persistently struggling, they were failing schools. And I think Eve mentioned it, that if you look at the population of those schools, you'll find that they're predominantly African-American, Latino, children of color. You'll find that they have high percentages of ELL students, high percentages of students with special needs. And, you know, it is clear that these schools have been targeted as the examples of schools that need to be brought down, have their assets, in particular their buildings, I think he mentioned that in terms of turned over to charter schools, and their children thrown out in some way such that the state can make an example of them for the rest of the state.
Explain, I think legislation was passed, was some of it was secretly almost put into some legislation last year that was passed that set up what is now the current crisis here in Buffalo and the other five states, that set up the receivership, set up the superintendents can be appointed from the outside, given 1 year, and some schools get 1 year to try and turn it around. Other schools maybe 2 years. But when in reality, they don't have 1 year because by the time everything is implemented, half of the year is already gone, which is setting up the schools for further failure. Clarify that for everyone.
Are you me or anyone?
Anyone.
Let me start and then ask the other ladies to jump in too. You know, you remember that plane that John King was famously building in the air while he was flying it? That's what I equate receivership to, because as that legislation became law in July of this year, 2015, the state ed department was beginning to write the regulations and the procedures by which the law was to be implemented. They were beginning to do education in July and August of the school districts that had to implement this law. And so it clearly is a work in progress. No one wants to really say that. At the same time that it's a work in progress, it is being mandated that the districts implement it. Now, Buffalo has gone on the offensive, I guess, in terms of our superintendent really being, again, the model for what happens in the rest of the state by being the first to ask the commissioner to override contractual issues related to the union and the schools that are persistently struggling so that he can implement this receivership law without the consent and the agreement of the union in this. So we are continuing to, set the bar as far as how this is to be accomplished, because we have a superintendent who obviously believes that receivership is the answer.
And I would say that this... Go ahead, Eve.
On top of that, I was just looking at the numbers last night. Buffalo has 25 out of the 144 receivership schools in New York State. If you do the percentages, almost 44% of our district is under receivership, which is the superintendent has power not just over union contracts, but also he is the chief decision-making force that supersedes our elected board of ed people. So he is basically able to make decisions without any local control or public input. And that's also scary, because when we don't agree with a board member, we can run a different candidate and hopefully get someone better. But when we don't agree with the superintendent, there's no due process. The superintendent's decision over these schools supersedes anyone else's.
And interestingly, I'm sorry.
Kate?
Yes, Dr. Miller. I was going to say that in school districts that are not under receivership, most of the schools in New York State, that is, particularly suburban schools, they not only have the community not only has the ability to elect board members, they have the ability to vote on their school budgets every year, which we do not have in the Big Five. And the board hires the superintendent. So now we've set up a structure where, since our board has not necessarily hired our superintendent, he was appointed. So even the structure of the chain of command has been changed here so that it disempowers the community. And I would say, if we could just pull back from Buffalo for a minute and look at New York State and the State Education Department, this receivership law that was passed in July of 2015 is very similar in the rollout and the way that New York State Ed Department brought us the Common Core State Standards, as well as the accountability testing linked to those standards. Everything has been hurried. Everything has been pushed out into the district with very little forethought, with very little information coming from the State Education Department, and in some cases from a teacher perspective, some of the curriculum that's come from the State Education Department was in the process of being written while we were asked to implement it. So none of it has been tested on students or, even things like typos in the lessons. There were numerous and ridiculous. So if you can imagine, listeners, that this idea of building a plane in the air, which is a metaphor for the New York State Education Department, it has affected the state as well as our city and our schools, with understanding that they're coming out with mandates, many of them unfunded, without even completing them before we're being asked to implement them.
I would characterize this again.
Hey, Jess, if I can just clarify something here, Dr. Miller, regarding the superintendent. No, the superintendent was not appointed. He was hired and he has a contract with this board, although certainly he came with endorsement and I think the encouragement or the approval of the commissioner. But I do want to say something that I remind the superintendent of all the time now, is that this is a system. We are operating in a system. Yes, half of it may be under receivership where he does not have to ask the board's approval, and but the other half is under the board's approval, under the board's purview. And so there's no way in a system that you cannot impact part of every part of the system when you try to maneuver and manipulate another part. The other thing is that there is supposed to be, per receivership law, a great deal of input and engagement of the community. There's this whole community engagement team that is supposed to be helping to direct and support and suggest programs within the schools. And so there is this at least semblance of asking for input from the community. And I consider the Board of Education as a stakeholder, just like any other stakeholder. So I'm exercising my right as a stakeholder to require information from the superintendent, to give him my input, to tell him what I think and what I'd like to see. And I've continued to do that, recognizing that the state has given him the final, quote, authority to make decisions, but he is not to do this in a non-transparent, you know, way and in an isolation of input from community stakeholders.
I would like to add to that, though. I recently attended a meeting in Albany with the education commissioner, and it was a community organization who was talking to the commissioner about the lack of time and preparation to really get meaningful community input on the CET teams. And it was not just Buffalo Voices. It was voices from Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, and Yonkers in New York City. All these districts
that have... That's the big five, folks. That's the big five that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they're the districts that have the most receivership schools. And person after person after person talking about their experience with the way the CET teams were being put together, and we were all concerned, and the stories sounded the same. That here you go, at the end of the school year, certain district schools come under receivership. Then the summer happens, kids are not in school, teachers are not in school. And then in September, you're expecting these fully formed CET teams. Parent involvement is one of the problems that we're already seeing in all of these areas of high receivership schools. We already know that's a problem. So if we want to get parent involvement, we need time to go out into the community to get parents to see that their voice does count, and to get them willing and able to be part of this process. But when you rush the process, you did not get as meaningful community engagement teams as you should have been able to. I have attended some meetings. I have attended community meetings in all of the receivership schools in Buffalo. And you don't get the parents out. You don't get enough parents out. And we told this to Commissioner Ilya, and she was not concerned enough. So again, reinforcing what Kate's saying is that it's a rush. You have the CET teams nicely on paper, but is it really, really pulling from the community? Are we really getting enough voices? Are we really spending enough time developing plans that could really be meaningful? And I just don't think we're given enough time.
Okay. Let me insert. Well, two things. The big five is Rochester, Buffalo, New York City, and who are the other two again?
Syracuse and Albany.
Syracuse and Yonkers.
Syracuse and
Albany. Syracuse and Yonkers.
Yonkers. Let me say something. You both of you, all three of you, are talking about things from a common sense standpoint. It doesn't make sense what they're doing. It's questionable and et cetera. Let me offer this. Think about this. How about if it was all planned? The legislation making this possible was snuck into the bill. It was passed. I think it was a budget bill. It was passed. Now, legislators, Democratic legislators, say, oh, my God, we didn't know about this. That may be bullshit, in my opinion. But you get it passed. You don't have time. By the time it's fully be implemented, half of the school year is gone by, which means those schools that are going to be affected are going to further be put in jeopardy to become privatized. I don't see this as accidental. I see it as part of the plan. And if you've been listening to the shows in the past, I use the term Machiavellian agenda. I think this is all part of Cuomo and those who are pushing this, part of their Machiavellian agenda. My thoughts, I'm an outsider who's been trying to stay up with this for months now, thanks to you, Eve, and your postings, and then the week that I've been here. What do you think?
Well, if I could speak to that, Dr. Miller, I have thought about that many times, and as a student of education and critical theory right now, I can't help but agree with you after reading so much about what's happening in the rest of the country, as well as this idea of following the money, starting with, you know, the development of the Common Core and all of the materials and the corporate push for schools to use those materials. I'd also like to thank Dr. Nevergold for just clarifying on the superintendent hiring process. I appreciate you clarifying that. That was important. But the other thing that got passed this summer in legislation was the fact that 50% of a teacher's evaluation is now tied to her student test scores. So, and that was up from 20%. So I see that as well as part of this agenda, which is to deprofessionalize teachers. We also have Teach for America teachers in Buffalo, which I'm sure your audience is familiar with, but they have a very shortened training, professional development in learning how to be a teacher. I think it's 6 to 10 weeks over the summer as graduates, undergraduates, and they are placed in high-need schools. So there's a whole bunch of factors coming in, but our state legislature needs to be held accountable, because this idea that 50% of a teacher's evaluation is tied to her student test scores is a very it's unreasonable, and there's no data that supports the idea that student test results on a standardized test, which has a lot of cultural and a lot of issues with the test itself, not to mention it keeps changing. But this also has contributed to the narrowing of our curriculum, so that my son now in school is not getting the same broad arts education, the same broader education that my older sons got within the same Buffalo Public School system. So that change, it affects our students. And I know that we're talking about bigger issues, big issues here, state-based and federal mandates, but if you really want to think about this, the most important thing to me is how all of this affects our community and our students. And I see the fact that teachers are stressed. I see the way that the curriculum has changed. These are the reasons that I left my teaching job, because curriculum that we have instituted because of all of this neoliberal agenda has changed, and it's changed the way we approach children as people. At our BPTO meeting, that's our Buffalo Parent Teacher Organization meeting on Saturday, we had a kindergarten teacher come and show us these very large charts, which delineated all of the testing that's involved in her kindergarten classroom. And I wish I could show you all a picture of it. It's overwhelming to think that 4- and 5-year-olds are being tested to the extent that we understand they are being tested. And that's not just in Buffalo. That's in all of the school districts across New York State.
Okay, ladies, we have like maybe 3 or 4 minutes left. I'm going to give up my report. I have been giving a report every week about what's happening on my trip, but I've decided that this was more important. I will take probably the last 2 minutes. So everyone, I'll give you about a minute to summarize the war, where we are, or the resistance to it, and then I'll take the last minute or so.
Well, just if I can jump in very quickly in terms of resistance, you know, I know that there is a resistance movement in the state of New York called Opt Out, which is, you know, led primarily by parents who recognize that high-stakes testing is all part and parcel of the war on public education. And as a result of that, I think they've been very successful in mounting an opposition to, you know, to the high-stakes testing. But I think that there is a relationship between that and resisting receivership. And we have a lot of work to do to try to get parents in the receivership communities, particularly urban communities, to recognize that this is one way of making their voices heard and combating what is happening with respect to undermining education in our city schools.
Okay. Eve?
When I look at what's happening in the Buffalo Public Schools and around the country, my worst fear is that schools will be privatized by these charter entities. And over time, just like we know that the charter schools can push kids out based on behavior or because they don't accept special ed students or because they don't accept ELLs or they don't accept low test scores, I'm worried that over time, we're going to have a real end to universal public education. And I look at Buffalo, and I know that it's being done so fast. It started decades ago, and it's been slow, but what can happen? That it's been accelerating. People are being pushed out of the process, and their voices are being silenced. And
okay.
If we don't fight this now, we're not going to be able to save our schools.
Okay. Kate?
First of all, I'd just like to say that I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these issues and to get this information out to more people. And that's a big role that we're trying to play, the three of us, is educating people on what's going on in public schools today. Because if they don't have children in the system, they don't understand the differences between the testing that's involved now for our students versus 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. So I often hear parents say, you know, this is the real world and you have to do things you don't like in the real world. And so, you know, these are the things that kids have to do. They have to take tests. But they don't understand the extent. They don't understand the reasons behind the testing. And so this has been a really good opportunity. And we will, all of us, continue to talk about this so that people start to understand and ask those questions. The opt-out movement in New York State last year had 20% of the students.
Kate, I'm going to have to cut you off because our time is running out.
Okay.
Thanks,
Dr. Folks, Miller. No problem.
I can't give my report this week, but I will say this. I've been asked to stay longer here in Buffalo by a lot of people, and I'm going to do that. Also, I don't quite know what's going to happen now. I'm basically running out of funds, and you, the public, and all the people who listen to the show and what have you, have not responded in terms of the GoFundMe campaign. At this point, I will be back here next week, most of next week. I will be going back to Boston Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then after that, I may have to return home and cut this trip short. Or I may go to Maryland if I can pull it off. But anyway, it's been a great week here, and maybe next week I'll say something. The people here have been fantastic. I've met some incredible people. We've interviewed maybe over 20 people, and there's still more who are calling and want to be interviewed. Today, I interviewed people the day before the show. One gentleman said his mother was one of six women, black women, who took on the whole city of Buffalo, New York, after the laws was changed to integrate the school. It was incredible. One of those women are still alive. He's trying to get her for me to interview. My second interview today, after interviewing him, he told me about one. There's a lady here who is still alive, who was one of the families who brought the Supreme Court case to the Supreme Court that ruled that segregation of the schools was unconstitutional. I mean, history-making people here. I hope to be able to interview them, and I've got to go, but I'm excited. Oh, I've been asked to move to Buffalo and help with the resistance. I've been to more rallies, school board meetings, you name it. I'm not going to move here, but I'm going to do my best to do what I can do to help the people here in Buffalo get the word out and fight back. With that, thank you, BBS, for letting me run over my time. See everyone next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.